So friends, the topic of today's discussion is the scientific foundation of ethics. Let's see where the word science originates from, the etymology of the word. It comes from the Latin scientia, which means knowledge, from the word scire, which means to know. Current connotation of science is what is generally accepted is the natural and the physical sciences. But the present scientific approach and study of and concerning with only the objective physical world is study of nature only in one of its aspects. It denies anything which is apart from or which is beyond the reach of the five physical senses. What is observable and recordable through the use of five physical senses is the limit of physical sciences. But trying to reach truth by studying only one of the aspects of nature and denying the existence of anything else, forget about investigating it and recording its laws, such an approach will be like studying the system of respiration, the function of respiration, by examining and studying only exhalation and not inhalation. So only one aspect is taken and it is seen to be the whole. Even before the birth of science as we know it generally, which is the modern science, science existed in all the prior ages. There are historical records of which we are studying in our IC Sunway study in Sunday mornings, which show that past civilizations like Egyptian, Indian, Chinese and so on were far advanced in not only the physical sciences but also the spiritual sciences. The moral and the spiritual aspect of nature was recognized by them apart from the physical. They were well aware of the physical but knew the inner real, which is the moral and the spiritual aspects of nature as well. Now HVB says in her IC Sunway that a fifth grade boy of an English school can prate more learnedly about the little things of physical science than Plato himself, but the dullest of the Plato's disciples could tell more about the great cosmic laws and their mutual relations and demonstrate a familiarity with and control over the occult forces which lie behind them than the most learned professor in the most distinguished academy of all day. So this clearly sums up where the ancient science stood and where the modern physical science stands. There are many differences between the modern science and the ancient spiritual sciences. One of them is, as an example, that the current science sees matter as organic and inorganic, as living and dead, and it sees life itself, consciousness itself, as a outcome of chemical and material processes. Life is merely a phenomenon of matter for modern science, whereas the occult ancient science, which went beyond the physical, recognized that there is nothing in nature known as inorganic or dead. Stones, minerals, rocks, even chemical atoms are simply organic units in profound lethargy. Their coma has an end and their inertia becomes activity, as HPB says in Secret Doctrine. So this is about just a brief mention about the modern science and the ancient science. Now, ethics. Ethics comes, the word comes from the Greek word ethos, which means character. Look at how the modern science derives ethics. There is this classification of sciences, and among the classification of the science, in the topmost, as the first level, is ratiocination, reasoning. And from that reasoning is derived mathematics. From mathematics is derived physics. From physics is derived chemistry. From chemistry is derived biology and other branches. From biology is derived the brain sciences. From the brain sciences is derived the medical sciences. From this is derived your socio-economic sciences. And finally comes law and ethics. This is the derivation of ethics according to the modern view of world and man, according to the physical sciences. But in the ancient science, occult science, in the beginning are, in the topmost first layer are universal principles or metaphysical truths. From that is derived ethics. Ethics were never a sentimental, emotional thing. It had and it has a deep root in metaphysical truths. This is something that we have to understand. While the modern science derives ethics from the physical origin, the ancient science derived ethics from metaphysical realities. So this difference and this modern view of life, which is, you know, consciousness and spirit as a resultant of chemical and mechanical forces, is very nicely explained. The reason for this is very nicely explained in the Sankhya Karika, where it is said, through the union between spirit and matter. Now, man is a union of spirit and matter. There is consciousness in him, and then there is the different vehicles in which consciousness displays itself. So through the union between spirit and matter, the insentient evolute, achetanam lingam, appears as if it is intelligent, chetanavat iva, which means due to the association of matter with spirit, matter appears as if it is intelligent. Just like we confuse and think that we are this body and identify everyone else with their physical structure, it's because of this ignorance. So what is achetanam lingam appears as if it is intelligent, chetanam, chetanavat iva. And similarly, he says further, from the agency of gunas, the spirit appears as if it were the agent, karteva bhavati. Spirit is not the agent, it is the origin of everything. It appears as if it is the agent. So this metaphysical truth explains our modern current tendency of science to see consciousness, life, spirit as an outcome of material forces. So, due to this ignorance, we confuse what is cause with what is effect. Cause is the spirit, effect is the matter, and we confuse these both. And what is cause is seen as effect, and what is effect is seen as cause. So, coming back to our subject of ethics, if we compare our modern view of ethics, it is changing, dependent on social conditions. It is very contextual. Whereas, if we study them according to the light of spiritual sciences, we find that ethics are eternal. They are not based on social conditions. They have a solid metaphysical basis in reality, and that they are based not on sentiment, not on the context of social conditions, but based on immutable laws of life, immutable laws of nature. If we take the modern view, we follow ethics because there is an external enforcement. But if we take the ancient view, we follow ethics because it is inherent in man and it is obligatory, not due to the fear of the law or the police, but it is inherent in man. Ethics is inherent in man. And if we are to take one ethical principle which runs across all the philosophies, all the religions, across different cultures and times, we will invariably reach upon this one ethical principle, which is compassion, love, charity or mercy. So, there are no Christian ethics, Buddhist ethics and so on. There are universal ethics which are reflected in all the religions. And the one common thing which runs across all religions is compassion or love, charitable attitude, mercy, forgiveness and so on. So, let us consider this one most important ethical principle and take references from various religions, what they say about it, and try to find its scientific basis. At the outset, we may say that this recognition of man's obligation towards all beings, to be charitable to all sentient beings, to be merciful to all, is based upon the metaphysical truth. This ethical principle is based upon the metaphysical truth that there is interconnectedness of humanity. There is interconnectedness of all sentient beings. This is the metaphysical reality, the truth, from which mercy, compassion and forgiveness is based. This is very nicely expressed in the Bhagavad Gita when Sri Krishna says in one of the chapters that as a single sun illuminates the whole world, even so does one spirit illumine everybody. What greater or what better representation than this, which shows that all beings arise from the same source and therefore are all interconnected. You know, in the Guru Granth Sahib we find this verse which says, whom should I despise since the one Lord made us all? Whom should I despise since the one Lord made us all? Just like Krishna says, I am the ego which is seated in the hearts of all beings. Similarly, we find in the Jaina philosophy that the spiritual nature of man is asserted. Man is not seen to be a body, he is seen to be a spiritual being, inherently a moral being. Morality is not seen as something outside, but inherent in it. That is what we find when we study the scriptures. They say that all souls are equal. The difference between souls or jivas, as they call it, is only in the bodies that they inhabit. Only in the bodies that they inhabit. There are bodies of air, water, fire, elemental, plant, animal, mineral, infernal beings, celestial beings, and human beings themselves. What is it that determines these different kinds of bodies that all the jivas inhabit? They call it, look at this, very interesting, they call it ashravas, asravas. Asravas means, the word means influx. Influx of what? Influx of karmic dust. So there is a, due to these asravas, which are 42 in number, they enumerate all the asravas, the jiva, when it gives in to these asravas, so to say, there is an influx of karmic dust, and that is what makes up the body, the character, and so on. Jiva in itself is pure, spiritual. Each one of us is that. But due to the asravas, the influx, there is these various multiple differences that we see. Let me read what these asravas are made of, 42 asravas. We will not enumerate all of them, just briefly. The five are the senses, four are the passions, anger, pride, love, and covetousness. Five are sins, avratas, which is killing, stealing, lying, adultery, and worldliness. Three are the activities pertaining to mind, speech, and action. And there are 25 other minor asravas which are seen, which are enumerated. Things like lending a weapon, wishing ill to any being, exercise of cunning, and so on and so forth. So these are the influxes which will attract these different kinds of which is what explains the differences in character among us. Therefore, they insist upon right living. To avoid these asravas and to go on the path of righteousness is what they say. And who are the Tirthankaras? Tirthankaras are those who have destroyed the glue in themselves which will attract the asravas to them. What is the glue? They say it is human passions. Tirthankaras are those who have destroyed the glue so that the karmic dust does not accumulate on them. So, here we see that there is a definite scientific basis for their insistence on right living, right conduct, right life, right kind of thinking and acting. And look at the motto of Jainism, which is based on this fundamental idea of interdependence. Their motto is Parasparo Upagraho Jivanam, which means all lives are bound together in mutual support and interdependence. Mutual support and interdependence. And it is from this premises, it is from this understanding of all beings interconnected, that there is no separateness. It is from this understanding, this scientific basis, arises the first of their Mahavratas, first of their vows, which is Ahimsa. So when this ethical principle of Ahimsa is advocated, person may ask, why should I practice Ahimsa? There is a reason behind it, there is a science behind it. If we study that science, we understand the reason for such ethical injunctions. And the science here is that all beings are interconnected. And even the modern science is on the border of discovering that interconnected is a reality. We'll come to that later at the end of this talk. So, you know, there is very beautiful verses in their sutras. I'll just read one of them from Acharanga Sutra, which brings forward this idea of interconnectedness. So there it says, I quote, I so pronounce that all the omniscience of all times state, speak, propagate and elaborate that nothing which breathes, which exists, which lives or which has essence or potential of life should be destroyed or ruled over or subjugated or harmed or denied of its essence or potential. This truth propagated by the self-knowing omniscience, after understanding all there is in universe, is pure, undefilable and eternal. In support of this truth, I ask you a question. Is sorrow or pain desirable to you? If you say yes it is, it would be a lie. If you say no it is not, you will be expressing the truth. What I want to add to the truth expressed by you is that as sorrow or pain not desirable to you, so it is to all which breathe, exist, live or have an essence of life. To you and all it is undesirable and painful and repugnant. That which you consider worth destroying is yourself. That which you consider worth disciplining is yourself. That which you consider worth subjugating is yourself. That which you consider worth killing is yourself. The result of actions by you has to be borne by you. So, do not destroy anything." Unquote. So, this is something that we can meditate upon, which so beautifully brings forward this idea of, you know, reciprocity, we may call it, the idea of ahimsa. Because if all beings are interconnected, if we proceed from that premises, if all beings are interconnected, if I am connected to all beings, then the harm that I do to another person, what happens? What happens to that? The harm that I do to another person is a harm done to oneself. That is why, you know, the Tirthankara says here, that which you consider worth killing is yourself. The differences that you see between you and another person, you and another being, is due to some kind of perversion of the mind which is there due to ignorance. Once ignorance is removed, as Tirthankara says here, once you become omniscient, then you see that actually there is no difference, actually there is no separation. So don't harm anybody, whether in thought, whether in word or in action. Because let's remember the three of the 42 asravas, which is the three modes of action, thinking, speaking and doing, physical activity. So in none of this there should be ahimsa. Ahimsa is actually not hurting someone physically or harming someone physically. In that very thought of separateness, there is ahimsa. That very thought of separateness, there is ahimsa. Himsa. In that very thought of separateness, there is himsa or violence. And they say that Tirthankaras or those who have completely reached this pinnacle of ahimsa. And if you study their evolutionary theory of how one becomes a Tirthankara, it's a purest form of evolutionary theory, most perfect. You know, the symbol of Jaina philosophy is a hand with a wheel in it, and in the middle of the wheel is written ahimsa. And in this one single symbol is contained so much that we can understand. So, in one sense it means that it is through your own actions that you will have to reach nirvana or liberation. There is no God, or there is no, the Tirthankaras cannot lift you. what you have done, so will you also reap. And you have to take the destiny in your hand and reach the goal for which you are here. And the wheel symbolizes the wheel of rebirth, the almost incessant wheel of birth and death, which one goes through until he perfects himself in Ahimsa. So the vow of Jainas is to relentlessly follow Satya and Ahimsa, truth and non-violence, to reach this perfect state and stop that wheel of reincarnations. For whom? Not for oneself, for all sentient beings. All sentient beings, the Tirthankaras work for the emancipation of all sentient beings. That is the vow that they take. We find this even in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. See, whatever scripture that you take, if you read it in the right spirit, in the right light, you find that all of them can be traced to one common universal principles. So now we consider the Jaina philosophy. You know, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, in the Yajnavalkya Maitreyi Samvada, we find this. Yajnavalkya says, for where there is, as it were, duality, the one sees the other, one smells the other, one tastes the other, one salutes the other, one speaks to the other, one hears the other, one thinks of the other, one knows the other. But when the self alone is all this, how should one see the other? How should one smell the other? How should one taste another? How should one salute another? How should one speak to another? How should one hear another? How should one know another? The purest form of unity or oneness is expressed here. And this is the fundamental basis from which all ethical principles are derived. Science tries to derive it through physical science. Ancient science derives it from these universal principles of oneness and unity, oneness of life. And the same thing we find in Mahabharata also. In Shanti Parva, Vidura advises King Yudhishthira as to how he should live his life. Something worth remembering. He says, listening to wise scriptures. Look at this. What is the first step? Listening to wise scriptures. Why? Because that is what will give us the right metaphysical basis, the right premises from which ethics are derived. So, I quote, listening to wise scriptures, austerity, sacrifice, respectful faith, social welfare, forgiveness, purity of intent, compassion, truth and self-control. These are the 10 wealth of character. 10 wealth of character. O King, aim for these. May you be steadfast in these qualities. These are the basis of prosperity and rightful living. These are highest attainable things. All worlds are balanced on dharma. Dharma encompasses ways to prosperity as well, O King. Dharma is the best quality to have. Wealth, the medium, and desire, kama, the lowest. Hence, keeping these in mind, by self-control and by making dharma, right conduct, your main focus, treat others as you treat yourself. Treat others as you treat yourself. So he finally says, tasma dharma pradanena bhavitvam yatatmana tatcha sarva bhuteshu vartitvam yathamani, which means keeping these in mind, keeping these 10 wealth of character, by self-control and making dharma your main focus, treat others as you treat yourself. So when we understand dharma and what it means, that provides the scientific basis for the ethics. If we take the framework of the modern science and try to understand the ethics of the ancient spiritual sciences, what do we understand? We must educate ourselves out of the framework which is there, which has been given to us through wrong religious education or the materialistic thinking which has come to us, and see the spiritual truths. Then we see what is the scientific basis for ethics. So here we see again the compassion, forgiveness, all that is mentioned. The reason is again very simple, that the harm that you do to others is done to yourself. So treat others the way you want to be treated by others. That is a golden rule which you find across all religions. And what is the harm that comes to us apparently from others? Where does it originate from? Why do people harm us? If you take the religious view, popular religious view, it is because God punished you, or it is because so and so planetary combination produced such a problem for you, and so on and so forth. And if you take the materialistic science views, it's all chaos, there is no reason, it's all chance, it just happened. You also fight for it. But the reason of all spiritual teachers saying that you should forgive, the scientific basis for forgiveness is that the harm that is coming to you is your own making. Any misfortune that happens, any disastrous event that happens, the pain, sorrow, suffering, disappointments, anything that comes to you has its root in your past actions. Somewhere either in this life or in your previous bodies, you have sown the causes for such a reaction to be set against you. And the person who is harming you is only a mere instrumental cause. The actual cause is yourself. Is only instrumental. So if you try to retaliate, if you resent it, then what is it that you are doing? You are actually creating more disturbance. And the harm comes to you if you forgive it and remove all traces of animosity from your mind. You have already balanced the equation, so to say. But if you retaliate, take law in your hand and avenge yourself and punish the other person, then what is it that you are doing? You are creating more disturbance. Through your ignorance, you think he is the one who is harming you, and you retaliate and create more disturbance, which has to be worked out again in the future in pain and sorrow. So the very word ethics comes from the word ethos, as we saw, which means character. Character is not important in modern materialistic view. Character is only incidental. If it helps you achieve success, material success and wealth, then it's important. Otherwise, you need not be moral. There is no obligation for you to be moral. It's derived. Where does ethics and law derive from? If you see the branches, if you see the classification of different sciences, it is derived from biological, chemical and socio-economic sciences that law and ethics are derived from. On the other hand, the ancient science says that man is primarily a moral being. Modern science thinks it is immoral. It's actually immoral. That is what it leads to. Ancient science is moral in its core, because man is primarily a moral being. He is not a physical entity. In his innermost nature, he is a moral being. He has a moral choice that he makes at every moment. This thing that we must remember. And why is this character so important? Because your destiny is dependent on your character. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad says, man is verily formed of desire. As his desire is, so is his will. As his will is, so he works. And whatever work he does, in the likeness of it he grows. Through his past work, he shall return once more to birth, re-entering whatever form his heart is set on. Unquote. So our destiny is not determined by any god, or neither is it by chance, but it is primarily dependent on your character. Therefore, ethics are very important. The suffering that we face, as well as the good things, good fortune, everything is a result of the moral choices that we have made in past. Therefore, ethics is important. And it doesn't stop there. What is the first thing that we discussed? That all beings are interconnected, interdependent. Therefore, what does it mean? My character colors everybody else's characters, and we are held responsible for it. Not only is my destiny dependent on my character, my moral nature, but the whole destiny of the whole race itself, of all sentient beings, is dependent on each one of us. This is the grave responsibility which man has. If he is of a lowly nature, of giving into physical the desires of the physical senses, and makes himself closer to animal tendencies, then he colors all beings and all their characters with such impressions. But if he elevates himself, if he ennobles his nature, purifies it, and generates desire for greater, purer and altruistic things, then he inspires others silently to be of the same nature. And as is the case, so will be the future of the individual as well as the whole human race. And each one will be held responsible for it. So that is the importance of character, ethos, from which is derived ethics. So, from this great responsibility that each one of us have, is derived another ethical principle of duty. Why is there so much insistence on duty in the ancient scriptures as opposed to rights? Because by doing your duties, your rights are automatically taken care of. That is the true meaning of that Hindu injunction, that dharmo rakshate rakshita. When you follow dharma, which is your duty, and do it rightly, anything that belongs to you will come to you and nobody can stop it. You need not fight for your rights. You need to do your duty, rights will be taken care of. Therefore, we find that because there is this great debt that we owe to all sentient beings, that the whole of the ancient social and family life was based on sacrifice. It is because of this that sacrifice was such a great part of their social and family life. You know, we all know the 5 yagnas which were prescribed for each one to do, the 5 sacrifices. It was because it is through this sacrifice, through this performance of duty, that the social, the human and the spiritual orders were upheld. It was not a sentimental appeal to people because of social relations. Duties were imperative because it goes to the very core of human evolution. The human evolution is dependent on each being doing its duty. And so, this in brief is about ethics and its scientific basis. But why do we not understand this? Why do we not know this? Because our education is such that it teaches us something opposite to this, something perverse, something which is of a contrary nature to what is actually real, for the sole reason that it discounts the moral and spiritual nature in man and considers only his physical aspect, only the physical unit. So if the question is asked, how do we demonstrate these ethics scientifically? It can be demonstrated very much, but not necessarily through the methods used by the modern science. You know, you take the premises of the ancient science and not the modern science. You take that as the premises and follow the steps which have been mentioned, which are necessary to be followed to reach a practical demonstration of the validity of these ethics, and then satisfy the conditions that are necessary for such a practical demonstration, and then the truth will be evident. This is no different from a student of chemistry who wants to demonstrate for himself what happens when two chemical substances, let's say A and B, are mixed together. First of all, what should he do? He must gain knowledge of these chemical principles. He must gain knowledge of these chemical principles, of the chemical, the framework of chemistry should be understood. And then he should thoroughly acquaint himself and then go to a laboratory, procure the substances, mix it according to the principles of chemical science and see the result for himself. But if the chemistry student sits in his house and says that I don't believe that substance A and B will result in C, though the chemistry book says it, I won't believe it. Nobody can help him. So an ignorant mind which decides to not take truth will be taking such a position. For example, in the there are preliminary qualifications necessary for study of Vedanta. They call it the sadhana chatushtaya, the four basic qualifications which a disciple should first acquire before he begins to practically understand the science of Vedanta. Oh, but if you don't satisfy these conditions, then you are not a adhikari. You are not qualified to study that. So one who undergoes this training and prepares himself is called an adhikari, or one who has the right to inquire into the mysteries of Vedas. So this being said, let's conclude here by mentioning that science as it is today is also reaching the borders of its investigations and finding that it cannot go forward with the limited view that it takes of nature. For example, a few decades ago there was a dramatic demonstration of the interconnectedness of the physical world by a scientist himself. It's a very well known, it seems that it is a very well known theorem, very well known demonstration which is accepted by quantum physicists, quantum mechanics. It's called as the John Bell theorem, and he showed that two subatomic particles which originated from the same source, however far they are in terms of time and space, they are always connected. That is, the change that happens in one particle is instantaneously reflected in the other particle, even if they are separated by galaxies. Space doesn't matter. So this is what destroyed the idea of locality, as the scientists call it. Locality means any event that happens is observable only in that local area. So if there is a supernova in some other galaxy, not know it sitting here, but the light has to travel, or some magnetic emissions have to travel to our Earth, and then we can observe it and then recognize that there is a supernova. So this John Bell's experiments destroyed this idea of locality and said that there is a non-local connection between two particles which have the same origin. And what doesn't have the same origin? Even according to science, the whole of this cosmos arose from the same source, which they call it as Big Bang. So there are many scientists, like one Dr. Robert Gilman, who is an astrophysicist, who recognizes that there are these limitations which science have hit, and that there is a prejudice in orthodox science. He says this very interesting thing. Let me quote him. He says, he is referring to studies which were done in parapsychology, which was published in the Journal of Parapsychology a few years ago, which showed that two persons are actually connected on the plane of mind. These were the experiments which were done, and the statistical result showed that this is not by chance that two of them, you know, seem to be connected, but there is a significant, the result is significant enough to show that actually there must be something which is connecting these both beings, who are separated by a wall wherein not even magnetic, electromagnetic impulses can traverse. So he is referring to this Robert Gilman, who is an astrophysicist. He has done his PhD in astrophysics and in Princeton University, worked in Harvard Observatory and so on. He says, most of these studies have concluded that there is some form of interconnection. But because of the profound philosophical and social implications of this result, the overall scientific community has resisted accepting the conclusions of these studies. My own sense is that if this were any other topic, the available scientific evidence would have settled the question by now. You should read his article, it's online, and he is very honest, and he confesses that there is definitely a prejudice because of historical reasons and because of current social conditions, due to which even the scientific enquiries and scientific experiments which prove interconnectedness in the physical world are not accepted by orthodox science. One of the reasons he gives is very important. He says, the dangerous and often bitter struggle of these early scientists with the church and with other philosophical schools left a profound impact on their successors. To this day, even historical justifications are long gone, those who enter the subculture of science soon learn that nothing is so damaging to one's credibility as the accusation that one is interpreting phenomena in any other than mechanistic terms, especially in any way that might be construed as giving consciousness a significant role in the dynamics of the natural world. Quantum physics has forced some physicists to break this taboo, but most of those in the biological, psychological and social sciences still keep the faith, unquote. Very honest scientist who clearly sees the historical reasons, and even he quotes other reasons why the scientific community is averse to, you know, giving even a little bit room for considering anything other than mechanistic view of life. mechanistic view of explanation.